This is Audible.
Avon and Harper Audio present Wicked and the Wallflower, The Bare Knuckle Bastards, Book 1, by Sarah McLean. Performed by Justine Eyre. Stay tuned after this production to listen to an interview with Sarah McLean and her editor, Carrie Farron. Prologue. The Past. The three were woven together long before they were aware, strands of spun silken steel that could not be separated, not even when their fate insisted upon it. Brothers, born on the same day, in the same hour, at the same minute to different women. The high-priced courtesan, the seamstress, the soldier's widow. Born on the same day, in the same hour, at the same minute to the same man. The Duke, their father, whose arrogance and cruelty fate would punish without hesitation, stealing from him the only thing he wanted that his money and power could not buy, an heir. It is the Ides of March the seers warn of, with its promise of betrayal and vengeance, of shifting fortune and inalienable providence. But for this sire, who was never more than that, never close to father, it was the Ides of June that would be his ruin. Because on that same day, in that same hour, at that same minute, there was a fourth child, born to a fourth woman, to a duchess. And it was this birth, the birth all the world thought legitimate, that the Duke attended, even as he knew the son who was to be his heir in name and fortune and future, was not his own, and still, somehow, was his only hope. Except she was a daughter. And with her first breath, she thieved future from them all, as powerful in her infancy as she would become in her womanhood. But hers is a story for another time. This story begins with the boys. Chapter 1. The Present. May, 1837. The devil stood outside Marwick House, under the black shadow of an ancient elm, watching his bastard brother within. Flickering candles and mottled glass distorted the revelers in the ballroom beyond, turning the throngs of people within, aristocrats and moneyed gentry, into a mass of indiscernible movement, reminding devil of the tide of the Thames, ebbing and flowing and slick with colour and stink. Faceless bodies, men dark with formal dress and women gleaming light in their silks and satins, ran together, barely able to move for the craning necks and flapping fans, waving gossip and speculation through the stagnant ballroom air. And at their centre, the man they were desperate to see, the Hermit Duke of Marwick, shining bright and new, despite having held the title since his father had died. Since their father had died. No. Not father, sire. And the new Duke, young and handsome, returned like London's prodigal son, a head taller than the rest of the assembly, fair-haired and stone-faced, with the amber eyes the Dukes of Marwick had boasted for generations, able-bodied and unwed and everything the aristocracy wished him to be. And nothing the aristocracy believed him to be. Devil could imagine the ignorant whispers running riot through the ballroom. Why should a man of such prominence play the hermit? Who cares as long as he's a duke? Do you think the rumours are true? Who cares as long as he's a duke? Why hasn't he ever come to town? Who cares as long as he's a duke? What if he's as mad as they say? Who cares as long as he's a duke? I hear he is in the market for an heir. It was the last that had summoned Devil from the darkness. There had been a deal, made 20 years earlier, when they were three brothers in arms, and though much had happened since that deal had been forged, one thing remained sacrosanct. No one reneged on a deal with Devil. Not without punishment. And so, Devil waited with infinite patience in the gardens of the London residence of generations of Dukes of Marwick, for the third in the deal to arrive. It had been decades since he and his brother Wit, together known in London's nefarious corners as the Bare Knuckle Bastards, had seen the Duke. decades since they'd escaped the country seat of the dukedom in the dead of night, leaving secrets and sins behind, to build their own kingdom of secrets and sins of a different sort. But a fortnight earlier, invitations had arrived at the most extravagant homes in London, the ones with the most venerable names. Even as servants had arrived at Marwick House, armed to the teeth with dusters and wax, with irons and airing lines. 1 week earlier, crates had been delivered, candles and cloth, potatoes and port, and a half dozen settees for the massive Marwick ballroom, each now festooned with the skirts of London's most eligible ladies. 3 days ago, the news of London arrived at the Bastards Covent Garden headquarters, and there, on the fourth page, a headline in smudged ink pronounced, "Mysterious Marwick to marry." Devil had carefully folded the paper and left it on Witt's desk. When he'd returned to his workspace the next morning, a throwing knife speared the newsprint to the oak. And so it was decided. Their brother, the Duke, had returned, appearing without warning in this place designed for better men and filled with the worst of them, on land that he had inherited the moment he'd claimed his title, in a city they had made theirs, and in doing so, he revealed his greed. But greed in this place, on this land, was not permitted. So, Devil waited and watched. After long minutes, the air shifted, and Witt appeared at his elbow, silent and deadly as a military reinforcement, which was appropriate, as this was nothing short of war.
"Just on time," Devil said softly.
A grunt.
"The Duke seeks a bride."
A nod in the darkness.
"And heirs."
Silence. Not ignorance. Anger. Devil watched their bastard brother move through the crowd within, headed for the far end of the ballroom, where a dark corridor stretched into the bowels of the house. It was his turn to nod.
"We end it before it begins."
He palmed his ebony walking stick, its silver lion's mane, worn from use, fitting perfectly into his hand.
"In and out, and enough damage that he cannot follow us."
Witt nodded, but did not speak what they were both thinking. That the man London called Robert, Duke of Marwick, the boy they'd once known as Ewan, was more animal than aristocrat, and the only man who had ever come close to besting them. But that was before Devil and Witt had become the bare-knuckle bastards, the kings of Covent Garden, and learned to wield weapons with precision to match their threats. Tonight, they would show him that London was their turf and return him to the country. It was only a matter of getting inside and doing just that, reminding him of that promise they'd made long ago. The Duke of Marwick would beget no heirs.
"Good chase."
Witt's words came on a low growl, his voice ragged from disuse.
"Good chase," Devil replied,
and the two moved in expedient silence to the dark shadows of the long balcony, knowing they would have to act quickly to avoid being seen. With fluid grace, Devil scaled the balcony, leaping over the balustrade, landing silently in the darkness beyond, Witt following. They made for the door, knowing that the conservatory would be locked and off-limits to guests, making it the perfect entry point to the house. The bastards wore formal wear, preparing to blend into the crowd until they found the Duke and dealt their blow. Marwick would be neither the first nor the last aristocrat to receive a punishment from the bare-knuckle bastards, but Devil and Witt had never wished to deliver one so well. Devil's hand had barely landed on the door handle when it turned beneath his touch. He released it instantly, backing away, fading into the darkness, even as Witt launched himself back over the balcony and onto the lawn below without sound. And then the girl appeared. She closed the door behind her with urgency, pressing her back to it, as though she could prevent others from following with nothing but sheer strength of will. Strangely, Devil thought she might be able to do just that. She was strung tight, her head against the door, long neck pale in the moonlight, chest heaving as a single gloved hand came to rest on the shattered skin above her gown, as though she could calm her ragged breath. Years of observation revealed her movements unpracticed and natural. She did not know she was being watched, She did not know she was not alone. The fabric of her gown shimmered in the moonlight, but it was too dark to tell what color it was. Blue, perhaps. Green? The light turned it silver in places and black in others. Moonlight. It looked as though she was cloaked in moonlight. The strange observation came as she moved to the stone balustrade, and for a mad half-second, Devil considered stepping into the light to have a better look. That is, until he heard the soft, low warble of a nightingale, Wit cautioning him, reminding him of their plan, which the girl had nothing to do with, except that she prevented it from being set in motion. She didn't know the bird was no bird at all, and she turned her face to the sky, hands coming to rest on the stone railing, as she released a long breath, and with it her guard, her shoulders relaxed. She'd been chased there. A thread of something unpleasant wove through him at the idea that she'd fled into a dark room and out onto a darker balcony, where a man waited who might be worse than anything inside. And then, like a shot in the dark, she laughed. Devil stiffened, the muscles in his shoulders tensing, his grip tightening on the silver handle of his cane. It took all his will not to approach her, to recall that he'd been lying in wait for this moment for years, so long he could barely remember a time when he wasn't prepared to do battle with his brother. He was not going to allow a woman to knock him off course. He didn't even have a clear look at her, and still he could not look away. "Someone ought to tell them just how awful they are," she said to the sky. "Someone ought to march right up to Amanda Fairfax and tell her that no one believes her beauty mark is real. And someone ought to tell Lord Hagen that he stinks of perfume and would do well to take a bath. And I should dearly love to remind Jared of the time he landed himself backside first in a pond at my mother's country house party and had to rely upon my kindness to get him to dry clothes without being seen." She paused, just long enough for Devil to think that she was through speaking into the ether. Instead, she blurted out, "And must Natasha be so unpleasant?"
"That's the best you can do."
He shocked himself with the words. Now was not the time to be talking to a solo chatterbox on the balcony. He shocked Wit more, if the harsh nightingale's call that immediately followed was any indication. But he shocked the girl most. With a little squeak of surprise, she whirled to face him, her hand coming to the expanse of skin above the line of her bodice. What color was that bodice? The moonlight continued to play tricks with it, making it impossible to see. She tilted her head and squinted into the shadow. "Who's there?"
"You have me wondering just that, love, considering you're talking up a storm."
The squint became a scowl. "I was talking to myself."
"And neither of you can find a better insult for this Natasha than unpleasant."
She took a step toward him, then seemed to think twice of approaching a strange man in the darkness. She stopped. "How would you describe Natasha Corkwood?"
"I don't know her, so I wouldn't. But considering you were happy to lambast Hagen's hygiene and resurrect Fork's past embarrassments, surely Lady Natasha deserves a similar level of creativity."
She stared into the shadows for a long minute, her gaze fixed to a point somewhere beyond his left shoulder. "Who are you?"
"No one of consequence."
"As you were on a dark balcony outside an unoccupied room in the home of the Duke of Marwick, it seems you might be a man of quite serious consequence."
"By that rationale, you are a woman of serious consequence."
Her laugh came loud and unexpected, surprising them both. She shook her head. "Few would agree with you."
"I'm rarely interested in others' opinions."
"Then you mustn't be a member of the Ton," she replied dryly. "As others' opinions are like gold here, exceedingly cared for." Who was she?
"Why were you in the conservatory?"
She blinked. "How did you know it is a conservatory?"
"I make it my business to know things."
"About houses that do not belong to you?"
"This house was almost mine once."
He resisted the words.
"No one is using this room. Why were you?"
She lifted a shoulder, let it drop. It was his turn to scowl.
"Are you meeting a man?"
Her eyes went wide. "I beg your pardon?"
"Dark balconies make for excellent trysting.
I wouldn't know.
About balconies? Or trysting?
Not that he cared. About either, honestly. He should not have experienced satisfaction at the answer. She continued. Would you believe that I enjoy conservatories?
I would not, he said. And besides, the conservatory is off limits.
She tilted her head. Is it?
Most people understand that dark rooms are off limits.
She waved a hand. I'm not very intelligent. He did not believe that either. I could ask you the same question, you know.
Which?
He didn't like the way she wove the conversation around them, twisting it in her own direction. Are you here for a tryst? For a single wild moment, a vision flashed of the tryst they might find here, on this dark balcony in the dead of summer, of what she might allow him to do to her, while half of London danced and gossiped just out of reach, of what he might allow her to do to him. He imagined lifting her up onto the stone balustrade, discovering the feel of her skin, the scent of it, uncovering the sounds she made in pleasure. Would she sigh? Would she cry out? He froze. This woman, with her plain face and her unremarkable body, who talked to herself, was not the kind of woman Devil ordinarily imagined taking on walls. What was happening to him? I shall take your silence as a yes, then, and give you leave to tryst on, sir. She began to move away from him down the balcony. He should let her go.
Except he called out. There is no tryst.
The nightingale again, quicker and louder than before. Wit was annoyed. Then why are you here? The woman asked.
Perhaps for the same reason you are, love.
She smirked. I have trouble believing you are an aging spinster who was driven into the darkness after being mocked by those you once called friends. So, he'd been right. She had been chased.
Oh, I have to agree. None of that sounds quite like me.
She leaned back against the balustrade. Come into the light.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Why not?
Because I'm not supposed to be here.
She lifted a shoulder in a little shrug. Neither am I.
You're not supposed to be on the balcony. I'm not supposed to be on the grounds.
Her lips dropped open into a little O. Who are you? He ignored the question.
Why are you a spinster?
Not that it mattered. I'm unmarried. He resisted the urge to smile.
I deserved that.
My father would tell you to be more specific with your questions.
Who is your father?
Who is yours? She was not the least obstinate woman he'd ever met.
I don't have a father.
Everyone has a father, she said.
Not one they care to acknowledge, he said with a calm he did not feel. So we return to the beginning. Why are you a spinster?
No one wishes to marry me.
Why not?
The honest answer came instantly.
I don't...
She stopped, spreading her hands wide. And he would have given his whole fortune to hear the rest, especially once she began anew, ticking reasons off her long, gloved fingers. On the shelf? She didn't seem old. Plain? Plain had occurred to him, but she wasn't plain. Not really. In fact, she might be the opposite of plain. Uninteresting? That was absolutely not true. I was tossed over by a duke. Still not the whole truth.
And there's the rub.
Quite, she said. Though it seems unfair, as the Duke in question never intended to marry me in the first place.
Why not?
He was wildly in love with his wife.
Unfortunate, that.
She turned away from him, returning her gaze to the sky. Not for her. Devil had never in his life wanted to approach another so much. But he remained in the shadows, pressing himself to the wall and watching her.
If you are unmarriageable for all those reasons, why waste your time here?
She gave a little laugh, the sound low and lovely. Don't you know, sir, any unmarried woman's time is well spent near to unmarried gentlemen.
Ah, so you haven't given up on a husband.
Hope springs eternal, she said. He nearly laughed at the dry words. Nearly.
And so?
It's difficult, as at this point my mother has strict requirements for any suitor.
For example?
A heartbeat. He did laugh at that, a single harsh bark shocking the hell out of him.
With such high standards, it's unsurprising that you've had such trouble.
She grinned, teeth gleaming white in the moonlight. It's a wonder that the Duke of Marwick hasn't fallen over himself to get to me, I know. The reminder of his purpose that evening was harsh and instant.
You're after Marwick?
Over my decaying corpse. She waved a hand. My mother is, as are all the rest of the mothers in London.
They say he's mad, Devil pointed out.
Only because they can't imagine why anyone would choose to live outside society. Marwick lived outside society because he'd made a long-ago pact never to live within it. But Devil did not say that. Instead, he said,
I've barely had a look at him.
Her grin turned into a smirk. They've seen his title, sir, and it is handsome as sin. A hermit duke still makes a duchess, after all.
That's ridiculous.
That's the marriage, Mart. She paused. But it does not matter. I am not for him.
Why not?
He didn't care. Because I am not for dukes. Why the hell not? He didn't speak the question, but she answered it nonetheless, casually, as though she were speaking to a room full of ladies at tea. There was a time when I thought I might be, she offered more to herself than to him. And then, she shrugged her shoulders. I don't know what happened. I suppose all those other things. Plain, uninteresting, aging, wallflower, spinster. She laughed at the list of words. I suppose I should not have dallied, thinking I'd find myself a husband, as it did not happen.
And now?
And now, she said, resignation in her tone. My mother seeks a strong pulse.
What do you seek?
Whit's nightingale cooed in the darkness, and she replied on the heels of sound. No one has ever asked me that.
And so?
He prodded, knowing he shouldn't, knowing he should leave this girl to this balcony and whatever future she was to have. She looked toward the house, toward the dark conservatory in the hallway beyond, and the glittering ballroom beyond that. I wish to be a part of it all again.
Again?
There was a time she began, then stopped, shook her head. It doesn't matter. You've far more important things to do.
I do, but as I can't do them while you're here, my lady, I'm more than willing to help you sort this out.
She smiled at that. You're amusing.
No one in my whole life would agree with you.
Her smile grew. I'm rarely interested in others' opinions. He did not miss the echo of his own words from earlier.
I don't believe that for a second.
She waved a hand. There was a time when I was a part of it, right at the center of it all. I was incredibly popular. Everyone wished to know me.
And what happened?
She spread her hands wide again, a movement that was beginning to be familiar. I don't know. He raised a brow.
You don't know what made you a wallflower?
I don't, she said softly, confusion and sadness in her tone. I wasn't even near the walls. And then one day, she shrugged, there I was, Ivy. And so when you ask me what I seek... She was lonely. Devil knew about lonely.
You want back in?
She gave a little hopeless laugh. No one gets back in, not without a match for the ages. He nodded.
The Duke.
A mother can dream.
And you?
I want back in. Another warning sounded from Whit, and the woman looked over her shoulder. That's a very persistent nightingale.
He's irritated.
She tilted her head in curiosity, but when he did not clarify, she added, Are you going to tell me who you are?
No.
She nodded once. That is best, I suppose, as I only came outside to find a quiet moment away from supercilious smirks and snide comments. She pointed down the line of the balcony, toward the lighter stretch of it. I shall go over there and find a proper hiding place, and you can resume your skulking if you like. He did not reply, not certain of what he would say. not trusting himself to say what he should. "I shan't tell anyone I saw you," she added.
"You haven't seen me," he said.
"Then it shall have the additional benefit of being the truth," she added helpfully. The nightingale again. Wit didn't trust him with this woman. And perhaps he shouldn't. She dipped into a little curtsy. "Well, off to your nefarious deeds, then." The pull of the muscles around his lips was unfamiliar. A smile. He couldn't remember the last time he'd smiled. This strange woman had summoned it like a sorceress. She was gone before he could reply. Her skirts disappeared around the corner, into the light. It took everything he had not to follow her, to catch a glimpse of her, the color of her hair, the shade of her skin, the flash of her eyes. He still didn't know the color of her gown. All he had to do was follow her.
Dev.
His name returned him to the present. He looked to Wit, once more over the balcony and at his side in the shadows.
Now, Wit said.
It was time to return to their plan, to the man he'd vowed to end should he ever set foot in London, should he ever attempt to claim that which he had once stolen, should he ever even think of breaking that decades-old vow. And he would end him, but it would not be with fists.
"We go, bruv," Wit whispered. "Now."
Devil shook his head once, gaze fixed to the place where the woman's mysterious skirts had disappeared.
"No, not yet."
Chapter 2 Felicity Faircloth's heart had been pounding for long enough that she thought she might require a doctor. It had begun pounding as she'd slipped from the glittering Marwick House ballroom and stared at the locked door in front of her, ignoring the nearly unbearable desire to reach into her coif and extract a hairpin. Knowing she absolutely mustn't extract a hairpin, knowing she absolutely shouldn't extract two, nor insert them into the keyhole not 6 inches away and patiently work at the tumblers within.
"We cannot afford another scandal."
She could hear her twin brother Arthur's words as though he were standing with her. Poor Arthur, desperate for his spinster sister, 27 and high on the shelf, to be released into the care of another, more willing man. Poor Arthur, whose prayers would never be answered, not even if she stopped picking locks. But she heard the other words even more, the sniggering comments, the names. Forlorn Felicity, fruitless Felicity, and the worst one, finished Felicity. Why is she even here? Surely she can't think anyone would have her. Her poor brother, desperate to marry her off. Finished Felicity. There had been a time when a night like this would have been Felicity's dream. A new duke in town, a welcome ball, the teasing promise of an engagement at hand with a new, handsome, eligible bachelor. It would have been perfection. Dresses and jewels and full orchestras, gossip and chatter and dance cards and champagne. Felicity would barely have had free space on her dance card, and if she had, it would have been because she'd taken it for herself, so she might enjoy her place in this glittering world. No more. Now she avoided balls if she could, knowing they offered hours of lingering around the edges of the room rather than dancing through it. And there was the hot embarrassment that came whenever she stumbled upon one of her old acquaintances. The memory of what it had been like to laugh with them, to lord with them. But there was no avoiding a ball bearing a shining new duke, and so she'd stuffed herself into an old gown and into her brother's carriage, and allowed poor Arthur to drag her into the Marwick ballroom. And she'd fled the moment he had turned the other way. Felicity had fled down a dark hallway, her heart thundering as she'd removed the hairpins from her coif, bending them carefully, and inserted one and then the other into the keyhole, when a quiet snick sounded, and the latchwork sprang like a delicious old friend. Her heart had threatened to beat from her chest. And to think, all that thunderous pounding was before she'd met the man. Though met wasn't precisely the correct word. Encountered did not seem quite right either. It had been something closer to experienced. The moment he'd spoken, the low thrum of his voice wrapping around her like silk in the dark spring air, as he tempted her like vice. A flush washed across her cheeks at the memory, at the way he seemed to draw her in, as though they were connected by a string. As though he could pull her to him, and she would go without resistance. He'd done more than pull her in. He'd poured the truth from her, and she'd offered it with ease. She'd catalogued her flaws as though they were a change in the weather. She'd nearly confessed it all, even the bits she'd never confessed to anyone else. The bits she held close in the darkness. Because it hadn't felt like confession. It felt like he'd already known everything. And maybe he had. Maybe he wasn't a man in the darkness. Maybe he was the darkness itself. Ephemeral and mysterious and tempting. So much more tempting than the daylight where flaws and marks and failure shone bright and impossible to miss. The darkness had always tempted her. The locks, the barriers, the impossible. That was the problem, wasn't it? Felicity always wanted the impossible, and she was not the kind of woman who received it. But when that mysterious man had suggested that she was a woman of consequence, for a moment she'd believed him. As though it wasn't laughable, the very idea that Felicity Faircloth, plain, unmarried daughter of the Marquis of Bumble, overlooked by more than one eligible bachelor because of her own ill fortune, and properly unfit for this ball, were a long-lost handsome duke sort of wife, might be able to win the day. The impossible. So she'd fled, returning to her old habits and stumbling into the darkness, because everything seemed more possible in the darkness than in the cold, harsh light. And he'd seemed to know that too, that stranger. Enough that she almost hadn't left him in the shadows. Enough that she'd almost joined him there. Because in those few fleeting moments, she had wondered if perhaps it wasn't this world she wished to return to, but a new dark world where she might begin anew, where she might be someone other than finished Felicity, wallflower spinster. And the man on the balcony had seemed the kind of man who could provide just that. Which was mad, obviously. One did not run off with strange men one met on balconies. First off, that was how a person got murdered. And second, her mother would not approve. And then there was Arthur. Staid, perfect, poor Arthur, with his "we cannot afford another scandal." And so she'd done what one did after a mad moment in the dark. She turned her back and made for the light, ignoring the pang of regret as she turned the corner of the great stone facade and stepped into the glow of the ballroom beyond the massive windows, where all of London shifted and swirled, laughing and gossiping and vying for the attention of their handsome, mysterious host. Where the world she'd once been part of spun without her. She watched for a long moment, catching a glimpse of the Duke of Marwick on the far side of the room, tall and fair and empirically handsome, with aristocratic good looks that should have set her to sighing, but in fact made no impact. Her gaze slid away from the man of the hour, settling briefly on the copper gleam of her brother's hair on the far side of the ballroom, where he was deep in conversation with a group of men, more serious than their surroundings. She wondered what they were discussing. Was it her? Was Arthur attempting to sell another batch of men on finished Felicity's eligibility? "We cannot afford another scandal." They couldn't afford the last one either, or the one prior. But her family did not wish to admit that. And here they were at a duke's ball, pretending that the truth was not the truth, pretending that anything was possible. Refusing to believe that plain, imperfect, tossed-over Felicity was never going to win the heart and mind and, more importantly, the hand of the Duke of Marwick, no matter what kind of potentially addled hermit he was. There had been a time when she might have, though, when a hermit duke might have collapsed to his knees and begged Lady Felicity to notice him. Well, perhaps not so much collapsing and begging, but he would have danced with her, and she would have made him laugh. And perhaps they might have liked each other. But that was all when she'd never even dreamed of looking at society from the outside. When she'd never even imagined society had an outside. She'd been inside, after all, young and eligible and titled and averting. She'd had dozens of friends and hundreds of acquaintances and invitations for visits and house parties and walks along the Serpentine in spades. No gathering was worth attending if she and her friends weren't in attendance. She'd never been lonely. And then, it had changed. One day the world had stopped glittering. Or, more aptly, Felicity had stopped glittering. Her friends faded away, and worse, turned their backs, not even attempting to shield her from their disdain. They'd taken pleasure in cutting her directly, as though she hadn't once been one of them, as though they'd never been friends in the first place. Which she supposed they hadn't. How had she missed it? How had she not seen that they never really wanted her? And the worst of all questions, why hadn't they wanted her? What had she done? Foolish Felicity, indeed. The answer did not matter anymore. It had been long enough that she doubted anyone even remembered. What mattered was that now, barely anyone noticed her, except to look upon her with pity or disdain. After all, no one liked a spinster less than the world that made her. Felicity, once a diamond of the aristocracy. Well, not a diamond, but a ruby, perhaps. A sapphire, surely. Daughter of a marquis with a dowry to match. Was a proper spinster, complete with a future of lace caps and invitations offered out of pity to look forward to. If only she'd marry, Arthur liked to say, she could avoid it. If only she'd marry, her mother liked to say, they could avoid it. For as embarrassing as spinsterhood was for the spinster in question, it was a badge of shame for a mother, especially one who'd done so well as to marry a marquis. And so the Faircloth family ignored Felicity's spinsterhood, willing to do anything to land her a decent match. They ignored, too, the truth of Felicity's desires, the ones the man in the darkness had instantly queried. The truth that she wanted the life she'd been promised. She wanted to be a part of it again, and if she couldn't have that, which, frankly, she knew she couldn't, she was not a fool, after all. She wanted more than a consolation of a marriage. That was the problem with Felicity. She always wanted more than she could have. Which had left her with nothing, hadn't it? Felicity heaved an unladylike sigh. Her heart wasn't pounding any longer. She supposed that was positive. I wonder if I might leave without anyone noticing. The words were barely out of her mouth when the massive glass door leading into the ballroom opened, and out spilled half a dozen revelers, laughter on their lips and champagne in their hands. It was Felicity's turn to press into the shadows, tucking herself against the wall as they reached the stone balustrade in breathless, raucous excitement. Recognition flared. Of course. They were Amanda Fairfax and her husband, Matthew, Lord Hagen, along with Jared, Lord Fawke, and his younger sister, Natasha, and two more, another couple, young and blonde and gleaming like new toys. Amanda, Matthew, Jared, and Natasha liked to collect new acolytes. They'd once collected Felicity, after all. She'd once been the fifth to their quartet, beloved, until she wasn't.
Hermit or not, Marwick is terribly handsome, Amanda said.
And rich, Jared pointed out. I heard he filled this house with furnishings last week.
I heard the same, Amanda said with near breathless excitement. And I heard he's doing the rounds of the doyen's tea rooms.
Matthew groaned.
If that doesn't make the man suspect, I don't know what does. Who wants to drink tea with a score of dowagers? A man in need of a bride, Jared replied.
Or an heir, Amanda said wistfully.
Ahem, wife, Matthew teased.
And the whole group laughed, making Felicity remember for half a second what it was to be welcome in their jokes and jests and gossip, a part of their glittering world.
He had to meet the dowagers to get London here tonight, no?
The third woman in the party interjected.
Without their approval, no one would have come.
There was a beat of silence, and then the original foursome laughed, the sound edging from camaraderie into cruelty. Fawke leaned forward and tapped the young blonde woman on her chin.
You're not very intelligent, are you?
Natasha swatted her brother on the arm and offered a false scolding.
Jared, come now. How is Annabel to know how the aristocracy works? She married so far above herself, the lucky girl never required it.
Before Annabel could experience the full lash of the stinging words, Natasha leaned in and whispered, loud and slow, as though the poor woman were unable to understand the simplest of concepts. Everyone would have come to see the Hermit Duke, darling. He could have appeared in the nude, and we all would have happily danced with him and pretended not to notice. With how mad everyone's made the man out to be, Amanda interjected. I think we were all half expecting him to appear nude. Annabelle's husband, the heir to the Marquisate of Wapping, cleared his throat and attempted to bypass the insult to his wife.
Well, he's danced with a score of ladies already this evening.
He looked to Natasha.
Including you, Lady Natasha.
The rest of the group tittered while Natasha preened. All that is but Annabelle, who narrowed her gaze on her laughing husband. Felicity found the response deeply gratifying, as the husband in question surely deserved whatever wicked punishment his wife was devising for not leaping to her defense, and now it was too late. Oh, yes, Natasha was saying, looking every inch the cat that got the cream. And I might add that he was a sparkling conversationalist. Was he? Amanda asked. He was. Not a glimpse of madness.
That's interesting, Tasha, Lord Hagen replied casually,
drinking his champagne for dramatic pause.
As we watched the whole dance, Annie didn't appear to speak to you once.
The rest of the group jeered as Natasha turned red. Well, it was clear he wished to talk to me.
Sparkling, of course, her brother jested, toasting her with his champagne.
And, she went on, he held me quite tightly. I could tell he was resisting the urge to pull me closer than was appropriate. Oh, no doubt, Amanda smirked, her disbelief plain. She rolled her eyes as the rest of the group laughed. That is, the rest of the group save one. Jared, Lord Fork, was too busy looking at Felicity. Bollocks. His gaze filled with hunger and delight, in a way that sent Felicity's stomach straight to the stones beneath her feet. She'd seen that expression a thousand times before. She used to go breathless when it appeared, because it meant he was about to skewer someone with his wicked wit. Now she went breathless for a different reason.
I say, I thought Felicity Faircloth left the ball ages ago.
I thought we drove her out, Amanda said, not seeing what Jared saw. Honestly, at her age and with no friends to speak of, you'd think she'd stop attending balls. No one wants a spinster lurking about. It's positively depressing. Amanda had always had a remarkable skill at making words sting like winter wind.
And yet, here she is, Jared pronounced with a smirk,
and a waved hand in Felicity's direction. The whole group turned in slow, gruesome tableau, a sextet of smirks rising, four well-practiced and two with a slight discomfort.
Lurking in the shadows, eavesdropping.
Amanda investigated a speck on one of her seafoam gloves. Really, Felicity? So tiresome. Is there no one else you might skulk upon?
Perhaps an unsuspecting lord whose rooms you'd like to explore?
This from Hagen, no doubt thinking himself exceedingly clever. He wasn't, although the group did not seem to notice, sniggering and smirking. Felicity lowered the wash of heat that spread across her cheeks, a combination of shame at the remark and shame at her past, at the way she too used to snigger and smirk. She pressed back against the wall, wishing she could disappear into it. The nightingale she'd heard earlier sang again. Poor Felicity, Natasha said to the group, the false sympathy in her tone crawling over Felicity's skin. Always wishing she were of more consequence. And like that, with that single word, consequence, Felicity found she had had enough. She stepped into the light, shoulders back and spine straight, and leveled her coolest gaze on the woman she'd once considered a friend. Poor Natasha, she said, mimicking the other woman's earlier tone. Come now, you think I do not know you? I know you better than anyone else here. Unmarried, just as I am. Plain, just as I am. Terrified of being shelved, as I have been. Natasha's eyes went wide at the descriptor. Felicity went in for the final blow, wishing to punish this woman the most. This woman who had played so well at being her friend, and then had hurt her so well. And when you are, this lot won't have you. The nightingale whistled again. No, not the nightingale. It was a different kind of whistle, low and long. She'd never heard a bird like that. Or perhaps it was the thrum of her heart that made the sound strange. Spurred on, she turned to the newest additions to the group, whose wide eyes were fixed upon her. Do you know, my grandmother used to caution me to beware. She was fond of saying one could judge a man by his friends. The adage is more than true with this group. And you should watch yourselves lest you be tainted by their soot. She turned to the door. I, for one, count myself lucky I escaped them when I did. As she made for the entrance to the ballroom, quite proud of herself for standing up to these people who had consumed her for so long, words echoed through her from earlier.
You are a woman of serious consequence.
A smile played at her lips at the memory. Indeed, she was. Felicity, Natasha called to her as she arrived at the threshold. Felicity stilled and turned back.
You didn't escape us, the other woman snapped. We exited you.
Natasha Corkwood was just so unpleasant.
We didn't want you anymore, and we tossed you out, Natasha added, the words cold and cruel. Just like everyone else has, just like they always will.
She turned to the assembly with a too bright laugh.
And here she is, thinking she might vie for a duke.
So unpleasant.
That's the best you can do.
No, no, it wasn't.
The duke you intends to win, correct?
Natasha smirked.
The duke I shall win.
I'm afraid you are too late, she said, the words coming without hesitation.
And why is that?
It was Hagen who asked. Hagen with his smug face and noxious perfume and hair like a fairy tale prince. And the question was asked with such condescension, as though he deigned to speak with her, as though they had not all been friends once. Later, she would blame the memory of that friendship for her reply, the whisper of the life she'd lost in an instant, without ever understanding why, the devastating sadness of it, the way it had catapulted her into ruin. After all, there had to be some reason why she said what she said, considering the fact that it was pure idiocy, absolute madness, a lie so enormous it eclipsed suns.
You are too late for the Duke, she repeated, knowing even as she spoke that she must stop the words from coming, except they were a runaway horse, loosed and free and wild. Because I have already landed him.
Chapter 3 The last time Devil had been inside Marwick House was the night he met his father. He'd been 10 years old, too old to remain at the orphanage where he'd spent his entire life. Devil had heard rumors of what came of boys who aged out of the orphanage. He had been preparing to run, not wanting to face the workhouse where, if the stories were to be believed, he was likely to die, and no one would find his body. Devil had believed the stories. Each night, knowing it was a matter of time before they came for him, he'd carefully packed his belongings. A pair of two big stockings he'd nicked from the laundry, a crust of bread or hard biscuit saved from afternoon meal, a pair of mittens worn by too many boys to count, too filled with holes to keep hands warm any longer, and the small gilded pin that had been stuck to his swaddle when he'd been found as a babe, run through with a piece of embroidery, on which was a magnificent red M. The pin had long ago lost its paint, turning back into brass, and the cloth that had once been white had turned grey with dirt from his fingers. But it was all Devil had owned of his past, and the only source of hope he'd had for his future. Each night, he would lie in the pitch black, listening to the sounds of the other boys' tears, counting the steps to get from his pallet to the hallway, down the hallway to the door, out the door and into the night. He was an excellent climber, and he decided to take to the rooftops instead of the streets. They'd have been less likely to find him if they gave chase. Though it had seemed unlikely anyone would chase him, it had seemed unlikely anyone would want him. He heard the footsteps ring out down the hall. They were coming for him, to take him to the workhouse, He rolled off the side of his pallet, crouching low and collecting his things, moving to stand flat at the wall beside the door. The lock clicked, and the door opened, revealing a thread of candlelight, never seen in the orphanage after dark. He made a run for it, weaving through two sets of legs, getting halfway down the hall before a strong hand landed on his shoulder and lifted him clean off the ground. He kicked and screamed, craning to bite the offending hand.
"Good God, this one is feral," a deep baritone voice said,
and Tevil went perfectly still at the sound of it. He'd never heard anyone speak such perfect, measured English. He stopped trying to bite, instead turning to look at the man who held him, tall as a tree and cleaner than anyone Devil had ever seen, with eyes the color of the floorboards of the room where they were supposed to pray. Devil wasn't very good at praying. Someone lifted the candle to Devil's face, the bright flame making him flinch away.
"That's him."
"The Dean." Devil turned to face his captor once more.
"I ain't going to the workhouse."
"Of course you're not," the strange man had said.
He reached for Devil's pack, opening it.
"Oi, them's my things."
The man ignored him, tossing the socks and biscuit to the side, lifting the pin and turning it to the light. Devil raged at the idea of this man, this stranger, touching the only thing he had of his mother, the only thing he had of his past. His small hands curled into fists, and he took a swing, connecting with the fancy man's hip.
"That's mine! You can't have it!"
the man hissed in pain.
"Christ, the demon can throw a punch."
The Dean minced.
"He didn't learn that from us,"
Devil scowled. "Where else would he have learned it?"
"Give it back!"
The well-dressed man summoned him closer, waving Devil's treasure in the air.
"Your mother gave this to you."
Devil reached out and snatched it from the man's hand, hating the embarrassment that came at the words. Embarrassment and longing.
"Yeah."
A nod.
"I've been looking for you."
Hope flared, hot and almost unpleasant in Devil's chest. The man continued.
"Do you know what a duke is?"
"No, sir."
"You will," he promised.
Memories were a bitch. Devil crept down the long upper hallway of Marwick House, the strains of the orchestra whispering through the dimly lit space from the floor below. He hadn't thought of the night his father had found him in a decade, maybe longer. But tonight, being in this house, which somehow still smelled the same, he remembered every bit of that first night. The bath, the warm food, the soft bed. Like he'd fallen asleep and woken up in a dream. And that night, it had been a dream. The nightmare had begun soon after. Putting the memory from his mind, he arrived at the master bedchamber, setting his hand to the door handle, turning it quickly and silently, and stepping inside. His brother stood at the window, tumbler dangling in his hand, hair gleaming blonde in the candlelight. Ewan did not turn to face Devil. Instead, he said,
"I wondered if you would come tonight."
The voice was the same, cultured and measured and deep, like their father.
"You sound like the Duke." "I am the Duke."
Devil let the door close behind him.
"That's not what I meant." "I know what you meant."
Devil tapped his walking stick twice on the floor.
"Did we not make a pact all those years ago?"
Marwick turned to reveal the side of his face.
"I've been looking for you for 12 years.
Devil sank into the low armchair by the fire, extending his legs toward the place where the Duke stood.
"If only I'd known." "I think you did."
Of course they had known. The moment they'd come of age, a stream of men had come sniffing around the rookery, asking about a trio of orphans who might have found their way to London years earlier. Two boys and a girl, with names no one in Covent Garden recognized, no one but the bastards themselves. No one but the bastards and Ewan, the young Duke of Marwick, rich as a king and old enough to put the money to good use. But 8 years in the rookery had made Devil and Wit as powerful as they were cunning, as strong as they were forbidding, and no one talked about the bare-knuckle bastards for fear of retribution, especially to outsiders. And with the trail gone cold, the men who came sniffing always dropped the scent and left. This time, however, it was not an employee who came for them. It was Marwick himself, and with a better plan than ever.
"I assume you thought that by announcing your hunt for a wife you'd get our attention," Devil said.
Marwick turned.
"It worked." "No heirs, Ewan," Devil said,
unable to use the name of the dukedom to his face.
"That was the deal. Do you remember the last time you reneged on a deal with me?"
The Duke's eyes went dark.
"Yes."
That night, Devil had taken everything the Duke had loved and run.
"And what makes you think I won't do it again?" "Because this time I am a Duke," Ewan said. "And my power extends far beyond Covent Garden. No matter how heavy your fists are these days, Devon, I will bring hell down upon you. And not just you, our brother, your men, your business. You lose everything."
"It would be worth it." Devil's gaze narrowed on his brother.
"What do you want?" "I told you I would come for her."
Grace, the fourth of their band, the woman Witten Devil called sister, though no blood was shared between them. The girl Ewan had loved even then, when they were children. Grace, who three brothers had vowed to protect all those years ago, when they were young and innocent, and before betrayal had broken their bond. Grace, who in Ewan's betrayal had become the dukedom's most dangerous secret. For it was Grace who was the truth of the dukedom. Grace, born to the former duke and his wife, the Duchess. Grace baptized their child despite being illegitimate in her own way. But it was Ewan now, years later, who bore that baptismal name, who held the title that belonged to none of them by rights. And Grace, the living, breathing proof that Ewan had thieved the title, the fortune, the future, a theft which the crown did not take lightly, a theft which, if discovered, would see Ewan dancing at the end of a rope outside Newgate. Devil narrowed his gaze on his brother.
"You'll never find her."
Ewan's eyes darkened.
"I shan't hurt her. You're as mad as your precious aristocracy says if you think or believe that. Do you not remember the night we left?"
"I do, every time I look in the mirror."
Marwick's gaze flickered to Devil's cheek, to the wicked scar there, the powerful reminder of how little brotherhood had meant when it came to claiming power.
"I had no choice. We all had a choice that night. You chose your title, your money, and your power. And we allowed you all three, despite Wit wanting to snuff you out before the rot of our sire could consume you. We let you live, despite your clear willingness to see us dead. On one condition. Our father was mad for an heir, and though he might get a false one in you, he would not receive the satisfaction of a line of them, not even in death. We will always be on opposite sides in this fight, Duke. No heirs was the rule, the only rule. We left you alone all these years with your ill-gotten title because of it. But know this, if you decide to flout it, I will tear you apart, and you'll never find an ounce of happiness in this life." "You think I'm riddled with happiness now?"
Christ, Devil hoped not. He hoped that there was nothing that made the Duke happy. He'd reveled in his brother's legendary hermitage, knowing that Ewan lived in the house where they'd been pitted against each other, bastard sons in a battle for legitimacy, for name and title and fortune, taught to dance and dine and speak with eloquence that belied the shame into which the three of them had been born. He hoped every memory of their youth consumed his brother, and he was consumed with regret for allowing himself to play the doting son to a fucking monster. Still, Devil lied.
"I don't care. I have searched for you for more than a decade, and now I've found you. The bare-knuckle bastards, rich and ruthless, running God knows what kind of crime ring in the heart of Covent Garden. The place that birthed me, I might add. It spat you out the moment you betrayed it. And us," Devil said. "I've asked 100 questions 1,000 different ways."
Ewan turned away, running a wild hand through his blonde hair.
"No women, no wives, no sisters to speak of. Where is she?
There was panic in the words, a vague sense that he might